Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending some time with me today. Ah, the movie musical, an art form nearly a century old, a staple in Hollywood's studio system of yesteryear. In the early days, classic movie musicals could be star vehicles. Think Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, and massive studio productions. Many were forgettable, and others have stood the test of time. The 2000s saw stage musicals become movies like Chicago and Dreamgirls, and then, of course, there's La La Land. In 2019, is the genre still alive? For Wesleyan Film Studies professor Janine Basinger, the movie musical has never really died. But since the 1960s, it has been dealing with sort of an identity crisis. Basinger is a celebrated film historian, author, and pioneer in the film studies field. She founded Wesleyan University's film department in 1969, when film was just starting to be taken seriously as an academic discipline. At Wesleyan, she taught future filmmakers Joss Whedon, Michael Bay, Akiva Goldsman, and more, and everybody has very good things to say about her. Whedon said, "She is evidence in all my writing, and I still call her whenever I need help. She is a constant in my life, the person for whom I'll drop everything." Julia Louis-Dreyfus said, "Nobody loves the movies more than Janine, and nobody knows more about the movies than Janine." And from film critic A.O. Scott, "I took a job teaching at Wesleyan as an excuse to hang out and talk about movies with Janine. There's nothing she doesn't know." Her new book is the 600-page comprehensive history, The Movie Musical, which spans about 90 years, from the arrival of sound and film all the way up to the present day movies like La La Land, which, by the way, she's no fan of. But we will get to that later. Janine, welcome to All of It.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Allison.
How did you become a scholar of movie musicals?
By accident. Really, I think most people my age became scholars of anything to do with movies. You just went to the movies all the time, day after day, week after week. You know, when I was little, movies were very accessible. They weren't marked for not appropriate for children, too much violence, too much sex, any of that. Whatever they had, it was all considered all right. It was the days of censorship, and your parents took you to the movies, and you even went to the movies by yourself if you lived in a small town the way I did. So I just saw all of them and accumulated them and became a huge fan of them from early childhood onward.
And when did you discover or realize that you could really think about them in an academic setting?
I guess I did that just... That's a frightening question. The answer might be never, but because I always do take them as fun entertainment. But by the time I was a teenager working in a movie theater as an usher and watching a movie musical over and over and over, I began to really, I think, at that point, give them serious consideration and start to try to take them apart and kind of understand how they worked and why some would work better than others and why I could really stand to watch a certain one over and over and over again and be perfectly happy. And another one I would be, you know, moaning and groaning and going to the ladies' room and closing my eyes and trying to, you know, something like that, ushering that way and seeing movies repeatedly over and over was a great way to learn not only about musicals, but about movies, because ultimately you're also watching the audience's reactions. And what you see is how much an audience will react the same way, and that you get the sense that they were guided to these reactions, you know, something that you just didn't think of when you're young. You just don't think of it that way, at least not in my era. So I think it started really in my high school years when I was working as an usher in a movie theater.
Let's get down to the beginnings. When do you see the first fully realized example of a movie musical as you define it?
It happens right away, oddly enough. Sound comes in, and I thought when I started that I would see an evolution toward greatness, but what I saw was a lot of back and forth and different kinds of things happening. But early on, right in the 29 and 30 and 31 and 32, musicals that are fully integrated with song and dance come on and are really good. One is a very obscure musical called Sunny Side Up with Janet Gaynor. It's an original movie musical, and people sing about their feelings and their thoughts to one another in the way that we think a mature musical should do. And another is a tremendously good 1932-33 film called Love Me Tonight, which is a kind of epitome of great musical presentation. It never gets any better than that, but and there it is right up at the beginning. But most musicals were backstage musicals. Obviously, that was the easiest thing to do, and it was something that people seemed to accept more easily because there was no reason then for the people not to be doing musical numbers. They were rehearsing them and then doing them on stage, so it was easier to put those together.
Well, let's take a little bit of a listen of something from Love Me Tonight. This is Mimi by Maurice Chevalier.
Mimi, you've got me sad and dreamy. You could free me if you'd see me, Mimi. You know I'd like to have a little son of a Mimi bound by.
That was Maurice Chevalier from Mimi. It's interesting, though, Janine, if you Google first movie musical, the results reveal something else. The 1927 movie, The Jazz Singer, but proving the internet isn't always accurate, The Jazz Singer has a much more complicated origin story. Why would that search result come up, and what is complicated about The Jazz Singer?
It is generally known in film history circles that for reasons which we cannot, I guess we can figure out, but people think The Jazz Singer is the first sound movie, the first sound musical. There is sound in The Jazz Singer, but very little of it. It is largely a silent film with some music in it. There are also musical numbers that are, you know, have the sound added over. But it has been the practice for many years to proclaim The Jazz Singer as the first sound musical. Since it is not 100% sound, technically one does not do that in order to be accurate. The business of Hollywood itself is partly to blame for this because they embraced the idea of The Jazz Singer as being the movie that brought sound to the world, shocking the world out of their shoes with, good heavens, you mean actors talk and they sing and they dance? Whoever thought of anything so crazy? And of course, you know, they liked The Jazz Singer for the following reasons. It starred a very famous musical performer, Al Jolson. He was one of the most famous people in America at that time, and he was a dynamic musical performer. The movie itself was surrounded by drama. The Warner Brothers studio was in financial trouble. The younger brother, Sam, pushed his brothers to sound. They fought over it. Just before Jazz Singer opened, Sam, literally the night before, practically dropped dead of a heart attack. He was married to a very famous movie star of that era, Lena Basquette. There was drama the opening night. Everybody was wailing and beating their bosoms and breasts, and Al Jolson went out into the audience and talked to everybody. And it's a colorful, fabulous story. And, of course, The Jazz Singer has music that everybody recognized and loved at the time. But it is not accurate to label it a musical exactly, because it's a dramatic story in which he sings. It isn't a musical per se with, you know, the way we think of it. And it is not really a talking movie, except in very few instances. It is a silent film with songs added.
Well, let's listen to one of those songs. It's Dirty Hands, Dirty Face from Al Jolson from The Jazz Singer.
Wonderful pals are always hard to find. Some folks have one, some folks have none. And I was alone for years, but fate was kind. And in the end,
that is Al Jolson from The Jazz Singer. My guest is Janine Basinger. She's written the book called The Movie Musical. Now, you mentioned that Jolson was this huge star, and a concept that comes up a lot in the book is the star vehicle. So what does that mean in the context of the movie musical?
One of the things about Hollywood is that it was a business, a total bottom-of-the-line, hard-nosed business. And whenever things came along available to them, such as now we have sound, we can do musicals, they started trying to find practical ways to really manufacture them. I mean, to turn them out rapidly, to find formulas they could go with. And when they did that, they thought of two things, stars and stories. And stars for musicals, of course, would be tremendously important. They could build a story around a star. A star like Jolson is a certain kind of performer. He does a certain kind of music. And so you could build a story around him and then repeat variations of that story. These were just vehicles. Bing Crosby is a great example of that. He had a sort of easygoing, laid-back quality. His stardom came through the microphone. He was a radio star before he was a film star. And he was a singer who had an intimate, easy way of talking through song to his customers on the radio. So they built that kind of a character for him, a laid-back, easygoing kind of guy. And then they just made him appear in stories like that in all kinds of settings. So those were called vehicles, star vehicles. It meant writing a story that fit the kind of music the person did and that fit the personality the person had and looked reasonable for the kind of looks he or she had. It wasn't, of course, only men, but that was the way the business worked. It made it possible for them then to roll these things out more cheaply and more economically and faster. So that is what the star vehicle was about.
Was Strike Up the Band a star vehicle?
Strike Up the Band is definitely a star vehicle because it's got Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland, and they were already thinking of pairing these two together. MGM, its home studio, had two great youthful musical stars, Rooney and Garland. So naturally they thought, well, what if we put them together? One of the things they knew is that pairs worked because if you had a musical and only one of the boy meets girl people could sing or dance, you had a problem. So you needed both of them to be able to sing and dance. So they had them under contract. They put them together in these teenage vehicles, and people loved them. So when you say vehicle, you're not talking about necessarily something second or third rate. You're just talking about a business practice that was very smart and practical and that worked for these studios who had enormous talents like Garland and Rooney under contract.
Let's take a listen to Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney do the La Conga from Strike Up the Band.
But in Havana, all the natives go 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney from Strike Up the Band. So this, it's interesting. You also in the book write about people who had wonderful careers but didn't really make it as stars of movie musicals, specifically Ethel Merman and Mary Martin. You write of Martin, quote, "The strange case of Mary Martin proves that musical stardom is linked to elements of personality that must, italicized, be seen on screen or no real movie career can emerge." What was so strange about Mary Martin?
Well, we know from history that Mary Martin was one of the really greatest of all Broadway stars. She had an enormously long and successful and profitable career, and she also managed to do TV with her Peter Pan presentations. So you look at her, she's got personality, she can sing, she can dance. Why would she not become a successful star in movies at around a time where someone like a June Allison does become a star? It's kind of like, what's the deal here? And, of course, the main answer to this question is the one that is generally given for anything to do with Hollywood. Nobody knows. I mean, it is a kind of business where you're selling something that you can't totally define. Stardom is an elusive concept. But for reasons that everybody debates, Mary Martin did not come across on film with the kind of personality and pizzazz and warmth that she apparently came across with on a Broadway stage. She just didn't. She looks quite a bit like another movie star, Jean Arthur, and that might have been an issue. She just didn't project. She didn't get the kinds of movies that created for her that signature persona that sold her to the public. She appeared with Bing Crosby, and he eclipsed her every time. She appeared with Jack Benny and Fred Allen. They eclipsed her every time. I mean, but it is a mystery because she was so successful on Broadway.
My guest is Janine Basinger, Professor Janine Basinger. The movie musical is the name of her new book. So when we talk about these early decades of movie musicals, what studios are we talking about? What was the competition like?
The competition was tough because the studios all made musicals. And not only did they make big, glamorous musicals, they made B-level versions of them. But the dominant studio, generally speaking, for musicals was MGM. MGM really dedicated itself to making musicals and really put under contract not only the great stars, but lots of musicians and arrangers and composers and choreographers. They did the full thing. 20th Century Fox was their closest big rival for making great musicals. They, especially in the 40s, during the war years, had people like Betty Grable, who was the biggest female star of her era. Warner Brothers made very good musicals in the early 30s with Busby Berkeley. The independent Samuel Goldwyn made really good musicals with Danny Kaye, and Paramount, of course, had Crosby and then Hope and Crosby, and of course RKO gave you Fred and Ginger, and it doesn't get any better than that. So, and Columbia, a low-budget studio, developed Rita Hayworth. So, you know, everybody had good musicals, but the dominant studio really, really was MGM.
My guest is Janine Basinger. The name of her new book is The Movie Musical. We'll have more with Janine after a quick break. This is All of It. All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest this hour is Janine Basinger, professor at Wesleyan and the author of a new 600-page book about the movie musical. So, Janine, in your book, you dedicate one of eight chapters just to the year 1933. What was special about 1933?
It's 1933 where you really see the musical is going to take hold, become a genre, and never go away. And it's also going to be varied and experimental, and it's also going to be quality work. In 1933, there were four people who really came to prominence. Two choreographers, Fred Astaire and Busby Berkeley, who are very different from each other, and two directors, Ruben Mamoulian and Ernst Lubitsch, who really showed that musicals could be original, personal. You know, if there's any genre that's sort of anti-auteur, it's got to be the musical, because the director, you know, isn't out there singing and dancing, and the talent and the putting it together are in the hands of so many other dominant people. But those two really showed how musicals could have song and dance integrated and be original and unusual. And the two dancers were people who really defined a unique approach that was cinematic. You couldn't go see the likes of Fred Astaire or the likes of a Broadway of a Busby Berkeley number at your local theater. I mean, live theater or on Broadway. What they did was cinema dancing.
Lyrics are incredibly important. We talked about the visuals and all, but if you have a musical with bad lyrics, it won't fly. And you single out one lyricist, Arthur Freed. He ran the Freed Unit at MGM. What were they responsible for, the Freed Unit? How were they innovative?
The Freed Unit at MGM is historically of enormous significance because they did make films that weren't musicals, but mostly they made musicals, and they were a creative force. Freed brought in the best people, Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire. He developed people like Sid Charisse to be partners and Vera Ellen to them. He allowed creativity. He allowed originality. And he really believed, of course, in songs and dances because he was himself a lyricist and a songwriter. So they had an enormous amount of success because there was so much creativity. And the people that Freed had in his, what was called, not really labeled a unit at the time, but in retrospect we call it a unit. He had wonderful people there, like Lenny Hayden. Like, he brought in the best possible musicians, and of course with that he had support from Louis B. Mayer, because it's expensive to do that. But they concentrated on treating musicals with respect and pushing them to be the best they could be, and to making them a respected genre that was Hollywood's original contribution. Not just coming from Broadway, the musicals, but original Hollywood musicals.
I did, since you mentioned Sid Charisse, I want to talk about Bandwagon. Bandwagon, you write, will in the end be a musical about how entertainment, popular art, can triumph over the pretentious.
Always my favorite topic.
I'm
committed to that idea. I think, you know, one of the things that Ruben Mamoulian said once that I thought was great was he said, you can get as much depth of meaning and emotion out of a musical as you can out of any kitchen sink drama. And it's true, the depth and resonance of musicals and how they stay with us and how we feel when we watch them and respond to them and how we take them away with us and how we want to go back and see them again and watch those numbers is because they do have meaning. They do speak to our minds and our hearts. They really do, and they just do it in such a great way. And Bandwagon makes that really the subject of the musical itself, and it's such a great entertainment. First of all, anytime you have Fred Astaire, you have the top quality that there is. He and Sid Charisse pair beautifully. Then one of their numbers, Dancing in the Dark, is one of the most beautiful romantic dances
ever
amazing. Put on film.
It is one of my favorites.
Oh, I love you. It's just so, no, it is. It's so lyrically fluid and just so elegantly simple, and it's showing us that these two people belong together. This movie has really great numbers, a lot of them, and they're varied, including the Girl Hunt Ballet, which was choreographed by Michael Kidd, a very new way for Astaire to dance, and he was up for it and did it very well. I just think it's a great musical.
Well, with that in mind, let's listen to That's Entertainment from Bandwagon.
The clown with his pants falling down, or the dance That's a dream of romance or the scene where the villain is mean. That's entertainment.
The lights on the lady in tights.
Or the bride with the guy on the side.
Or the ball where she gives him her all. That's entertainment.
We're talking movie musicals with Professor Janine Basinger. She's written a new book, 600-page book about the movie musical. And I guess by telling you about Bandwagon, I've outed myself as a kid who had her nose pressed against the TV on Saturday nights watching PBS.
Good for you. Good for you. You've done well by what you learned.
Which brings me to, I think there was about a month where they played Singing in the Rain every Saturday night. And
oh,
I was
boy.
There. Every Saturday night. You call it the musical for people who don't like musicals.
Yes. Well, you know, here's what I've learned over my years of programming. When you go to program for an audience you don't know, if you're going to do a musical, show Singing in the Rain, you're totally safe because the people who hate musicals will love it, and the people who love musicals will love it, and I don't think there's anybody else. They usually fall into those two categories. Show me the person who doesn't like it, and I'll run. I'll run in the other direction.
It's got one of my favorite lines in any movie. Lena Lamont, the beautiful movie star of the silent films, who's got this high, squeaky voice, and they try to put something over, and she goes, "What do you think, I'm dumb or something? I got more money than Calvin Coolidge put together."
Isn't that great? Sometimes one of the things we forget is that behind the scenes, the level of talent working on this film in every possible category is the best that there was in America at that time working in Hollywood. It's phenomenal, really.
And I also think Donald O'Connor should get his due. He sort of gets left out because it's always Gene Kelly and Debbie Reynolds, but Donald O'Connor's amazing.
I agree with you, and Donald O'Connor is one of my favorites, and he is underrated. The dancing he can do, that Make 'Em Laugh number, is awesome, but when he's dancing to Moses Supposes,
his toes are roses,
yeah,
Moses
you
supposes,
can see how
erroneously.
Great he is. He's great. He's really great.
All right, we're going to play a little Singing in the Rain.
I'm going to stop
singing.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready for love. Let the storm.
So, Janine, as we're having this conversation about movie musicals, we have to acknowledge that people of color were absent from a lot of these musicals for a long time, and that Al Jolson was famous in his career for wearing blackface. What are some really good movie musicals or performances from people of color you think have been overlooked?
Well, I regret that, you know, so many fantastically talented people did not get their chance to be in these musicals and to star in them and to be featured the way they were, because the amount of talent was prodigious, and it's a great loss. But a musical that I really like that is an all-black musical, Stormy Weather, is one that I write about. I like Cabin in the Sky. Many people have problem with the subject matter, although the talent is wonderful. But when you look at a movie like Stormy Weather, it was particularly designed to feature the really talented musicians of that time who hadn't been given the feature films they deserved. You have Bojangles, Bill Robinson, a fabulous dancer. You have Lena Horne, one of the most beautiful and talented women ever, who can do drama as well as comedy and sing so magnificently. But you've got Dooley Wilson, you've got Fats Waller, you've got this whole Cab Calloway, you have this lineup of just the Nicholas, everybody is so great, and when you look at that talent, it's wonderful. When you see the specialty numbers in other films that people like the Nicholas Brothers or the Berry Brothers or, you know, sometimes Bill Robinson or others had, you realize the great musicals that we've missed out on. I would have believed Fats Waller as anything. As I said, Fats Waller could play Hamlet, and I'd believe it. He was such a great performer, had such musical chops, but also such a personality. There's just so much that that you wish you had that you don't have. But to look at a movie like Stormy Weather in 1943, you see all these people, including the Katharine Dunham dance unit, who are just fabulous dancers, and she was such an innovative choreographer. You have an opportunity to at least see what you didn't get enough of.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Lena Horne and Stormy Weather.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather.
I'm going to put out there, Janine, one of my favorite musicals was Pearly growing up when I was little.
Yes, and I didn't really write about Pearly. I like Pearly, too, and it I'm glad you mentioned it. It should be better known. When I came to, and as you've pointed out, this book is over 600 pages. I mean, I could still be writing it, believe me. But I had to start making choices for what I would write about that came in the later eras. And which ones were the more innovative or stranger ones? I couldn't just do fun ones that I loved. I chose to write about the movie Idlewild because it's a movie most people don't know. And it is, I think, a really imaginative, unusual movie that was very innovative. It doesn't entirely work, but it shows people who were creative, freewheeling. They were making music and they were daring to play with cinema. They've got talking roosters and cuckoo clocks and everything. It's just, I really would like for people to look at that movie and to find out about it, whereas I felt that Pearly was a movie more people had a chance to see. It was one of those choices I hated to make.
Let's take a listen to Melba Moore from Pearly.
To charm the bees, the flowers flower just for Pearly, Pearly. Why he can steal the evening breezes, stare the sun down until it freezes. I just can't wait to greet each day, to blank my eyes and to say to Pearly, Pearly.
Oh, I still know every word. That is ridiculous. Janine Basinger is the founder of the Department of Film Studies at Wesleyan University and the curator of cinema archives there. Her new book is called The Movie Musical! Exclamation point. Janine, thank you so much for joining us on All of It. Let's go out with some more music.
A pool table, don't you understand? Friend, either you're closing your eyes to a situation you do not wish to acknowledge, or you are not aware of the caliber of disaster indicated by the presence of a pool table in your community. Well, you got trouble, my friend. Right here, I say trouble right here in River City. Why, sure, I'm a billiard player. Certainly mighty proud to say I'm always mighty proud to say it. I consider that the hours I spend with a cue in my hand are golden. Help you cultivate horse sense and a cool head and a keen eye. Did you ever take and try to find an ironclad lead for yourself from a three-rail billiard shot? But just as I say it takes judgment, brains, and maturity to score in a balk-line game, I say that any boob can take and shove a ball in a pocket. And I call that sloth the first big step on the road to the depths of degrade. I say first, medicinal wine from a teaspoon, then beer from a bottle. And the next thing you know, your son is playing for money in a pinchback suit.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.